Welcome to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. Governor Ron DeSantis is wrapping up his first month in office, and the environment has marked a lot of it. He's called for additional funding for Everglades restoration, improved water quality, and he's called for the entire board of the South Florida Water Management District to resign. This is the governor this week in Tallahassee.
I've been very mute about criticism. I have not done that because I'd rather just look forward. But there will come a point where if they don't see the light, we're going to make them feel the heat because I think we need to get this right going forward.
Now, seven members of the nine-member board have announced their resignations. Two remaining board members will leave in March when their terms expire. This week in Fort Lauderdale, the governor announced two appointments. Chauncey Goss of Sanibel City in Southwest Florida and Ron Bergeron, a Broward County native, one-time alligator wrestler, real estate developer, longtime conservationist, and a former member of the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. Here's Bergeron this week.
You know, I remember being here about 72 years ago, which I'm telling my age, as a little boy that got in an airboat with his grandfather and and was introduced to one of the natural wonders of the world, the Florida Everglades.
An emotional moment there for Ron. The Water Management District may not be in the headlines often, but it is pivotal in moving water around our region. How water is used and determining how clean it is. 800-743-WLRN as we begin the South Florida Roundup talking about water and the management of water. 800-743-9576. You can also send us a tweet at WLRN. Ron Bergeron joins us now via FaceTime. Mr. Bergeron, congratulations on your intended appointment to the South Florida Water Management District. Why'd you take the job? Why are you interested in this?
Well, thank you. It was a great honor, and I want to thank the governor for giving me the opportunity to make a difference for all of South Florida. For 8 million people that rely on the Everglades for drinking water. And obviously, without protecting our surroundings, our quality of life could change dramatically. So it's a great opportunity. I've spent half my life trying to save this beautiful environment.
What are your priorities on the board as you move into that position? What is it that you want to accomplish during your tenure?
Well, I think I would pick up where I left off as a commissioner for the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, appointed by two governors for a decade. I was the point commissioner for the FWC over Everglades Restoration. As I look at the Everglades, and of course the joint venture partnership signed with the federal government back in 2000, and as we've proceeded forward to construct many reservoirs and pretreatment areas and building bridges to decompartmentalize the system so we have the natural flow from the northern Everglades through the central, into the southern, and on to Florida Bay, that's been impacted dramatically from lack of fresh water. And when you look at what we've spent over the last 18 years, the first thing I want to do is look at any projects that have a missing link to getting the benefits of what we've spent over the last 18 years. And be short-term benefits from what we've done over the past 18 years. That would be one of the first steps I would take.
Give us an example of what it is you would be looking for. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is in such a powerful position regarding Everglades restoration, South Florida Water Management District also obviously holding an important position here. But it really is those federal engineers that that are kind of at the keystone of bridging between the written word of the restoration plan and the engineering of moving the water around in a different way.
Well, that's true, and I think the important thing is modified water delivery that allows water to get beyond the Tamiami Trail. Now, about 5 years ago, or maybe 4 years ago, we completed the first one-mile bridge. Mm-hmm. We're in process of constructing the 2.6-mile bridge, which will give us 3.6 miles of bridges to allow water to flow to Florida Bay. And I think it's extremely important that any obstacles that would restrict that water flow to Florida Bay is extremely important, because the 1,500,000 acre feet of water that flowed naturally before man compartmentalized the system, extremely important to Florida Bay, and would alleviate the high water events in the central Everglades.
Yeah.
And also that quantity of water would not be going east and west out our rivers in quantities that are not natural.
So it sounds like moving the water south is one of those priorities that you have. Speaking with Ron Bergeron, intended appointment to the South Florida Water Management District, that intention announced this week by Governor Ron DeSantis. Ron, hold on the line here. Kimberly Miller is with us as well. She watches over that portion of the Everglades for the Palm Beach Post, with us on the telephone. Kimberly, tell us about the round of resignations that have happened here and how the board is operating right now and what the governor intends to do with it, and what the appointment of Bergeron tells you about what the governor wants to do at the board level.
Well, I think right now the district is looking to see if there are going to be any new appointments before the next board meeting, which is the 15th, I believe. And the senior staff, I think, is a little bit concerned about what their job is going to be. And I would like to ask the new commissioner what his thoughts are, if there was going to be any kind of review of the senior staff, of the executive director's position, or any other higher level spots.
Ron, are you going to review the staffing there?
Well, we certainly we would do the staffing, and I don't know what the governor's intention is at this point. I've had great relationships with Ernie Marks. I've dealt with Ernie with the DEP for nearly a decade.
Department of Environmental Protection for the state.
Yeah, that's correct. And then he was also my regional director under my supervision in the Southern District of the FWC in South Florida for a couple of years, and has a great deal of knowledge of the environment.
Ron, we're having the FaceTime break up just a little bit. Sorry to interrupt you there, Mr. Bergeron. I'll have you try to get a little bit closer to your microphone. Ron Bergeron is with us via FaceTime. Jenny Stiletovich, covering the environment for our partner, the Miami Herald, also with us. Jenny, the district is often overlooked. As I said, it's not oftentimes in the headlines, but what is its role in shaping environmental policy as it relates to water in South Florida? What's its focus been, and how could that evolve under DeSantis?
Well, I think one of its chief responsibilities is making sure the water is clean. You were right when you said the Army Corps engineers kind of design the structures. That's been their primary role, is the plumbing. But the Water Management District and the state's responsibility is making sure the water is clean enough to get down into the park.
And how does the leadership of DeSantis potentially change that? He's announced, what, $645 million of environmental investment that he'd like to make. Not all of that, of course, going to the Everglades and to deal with Lake Okeechobee and the blue-green algae. But what's the role of the Water Management District that Mr. Bergeron's stepping into here?
Well, so right now the Water Management District is trying to end federal oversight of the clean water. So what's not clear yet is whether that's going to proceed forward. The lawsuit or the motions were filed in court under the previous governing board, and there is a status hearing on February 11th, three days before the next hearing. So the question is, will that move forward if a judge, Judge Moreno, rules on that, and ends federal oversight? That would be huge. That is the one thing that a lot of people have said have ensured that the Everglades National Park didn't get dirty water and didn't get overrun with cattails and everything else.
Ron Bergeron, how about it? Do you support the end of federal oversight for water quality in the district?
Well, I think the water quality is very important. We have built substantial pretreatment areas along the L5 at the Broward-Palm Beach County line, which has improved our quality of water tremendously. And most of the water that is going into Everglades National Park, from what I've reviewed, is right at or very close to the 10 parts per billion. So I think we've come a long way on quality of water as it enters into the central Everglades, mm-hmm. and then on into the southern, into Florida Bay.
So does the federal government still play a role, do you think, in monitoring that water quality going forward?
Well, they have a role in monitoring that quality of water all the time that I've been involved as a point commissioner. And I think the key to getting the quality of water is the distribution at the Tamiami Trail, which I proposed a spreader mm-hmm. swale that would run parallel to the Tamiami Trail, and of course water will flow against to the lowest point and then overflow in all the sloughs where water flowed naturally before the Tamiami Trail.
Yeah.
And that spreads out the nutrients to lower the distribution as well.
Kimberly Miller with the Palm Beach Post, you're hearing the incoming commissioner talk a lot about moving the water south, moving it south of Tamiami Trail, getting it into the central Everglades. What are the challenges that the district, though, faces between there and the Hoover Dike, the southern lip of Lake Okeechobee, that it needs to address?
Well, right now they're dealing with building this huge southern reservoir, which is their biggest project at this point, and trying to get the Army Corps of Engineers to sign off on it and make recommendations to the leadership there. And I think that's one of the things that some of the board members wanted to stay on to try and see through. It was such a big issue with the former Senate President Joe Negron, and they were able to push it through quickly, and they just don't want to see that stalled. So right now I think that's the one of the biggest priorities. That and the other reservoir, which is on the western side of the lake for near the Coosahatchee, mm-hmm. is supposed to help clean some of the water over there, the C-43.
Jenny Stiletovich with the Miami Herald. How significant are these changes, having essentially an entirely reconstituted board of the largest water management district in Florida, if not perhaps the most important one?
Well, I think it could, depending on the board, they could shift the focus on some projects. The Everglades Reservoir is a really good example. There are some questions over how well that reservoir would work. If the Corps is still reviewing the design and the modeling done for that, if there are significant questions, this board could back off or you know, I don't know exactly how it would move forward, but that they could shift the focus.
So, Ron Bergeron, what about that reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee that the state legislature began funding money for over the past session or so, as we saw a couple of lost summers along the Gulf Coast and East Coast because of the polluted water out of Lake Okeechobee having to pour out of the lake to help keep that lake level down. Do you support that reservoir south of Lake O?
Well, I would have to be updated totally on the cost versus benefit, value engineering on the benefits of the reservoir. There's no question that reservoirs is a very big component of Everglades restoration. When the flood district was established back in the late 40s, brought on by two hurricanes, obviously when they drew the line, the half they chose to save where people live today is being mm-hmm. pumped on the half they chose. The half they chose to drain is being pumped on the half they chose to save, with half the area and the same amount of rain as we had 100 years ago. So reservoirs are going to be very important to store the water and feed it to the Everglades, compatible with the environment, the ecology, all around.
Yeah, well, let me ask you this, Mr. Bergeron. Do you support do you support any reservoir south? Obviously, a lot of investigation around, the science and where. But the push has been to store the water south of Lake Okeechobee before it gets into the estuaries. Do you support the construction, using state dollars for the construction of that kind of pool?
Well, I think the reservoir is important. The only evaluation that I would want to make is that the right location? And I think the important thing when you look at all the nutrients that are coming in from the north through Fish Eating Creek and Kissimmee River and Taylor mm-hmm. Creek and mm-hmm. and
those are all tributaries into Lake Okeechobee from the north.
The point is that we've got to have cooperation by agriculture, and we've got to be able to pre-treat the water and store the water prior before it gets into the lake. And so I think there needs to be an evaluation. I think the reservoir south of the A, once I get fine-tuned on everything, mm-hmm. we want to look at where we're getting the most benefit and cost versus benefit and value engineering. And it's important that we don't exclude Lake Okeechobee
yeah.
from that. The Northern Everglades is as important as the Central and the Southern.
Mm-hmm. And those tributaries into Lake Okeechobee are part of the South Florida Water Management District's responsibility. Kim Miller with the Palm Beach Post, how significant is it if you've got this new member, Ron Bergeron, talking about looking north of Lake Okeechobee for solutions?
Well, I think everybody agrees at some point that we need to look north for solutions. I mean, this southern reservoir was in the, SB 10, which was the bill that created mm-hmm. it. It's in law. I don't know. I mean, it is significant. If people are questioning it at this point, I don't even know what could happen to make it change, maybe buy more land. But I know the district tried to do that. They tried to get some of the farmers in the area to sell, and they were unwilling to do that. I know that has been a request from some of the environmentalists. They always wanted a bigger footprint of the property. So, no, I think that's very significant. It's very interesting, and we'll have to see how it proceeds.
Jenny Stiletovich, what are you hearing there in that?
I'm sorry, you mean as far as the progress of the reservoir?
The progress of the reservoir, and also Ron Bergeron talking about looking north of Lake Okeechobee for additional solutions.
Right. No, I agree with Kim and Mr. Bergeron that looking north has always been part of the plan, too. I mean, there was that big University of Florida study done, I think it's been a couple of years ago now, that said, in fact, we need storage north and south. The question that I always come back to, and I think a lot of people, is you've got the storage now. Can you make the water clean enough to send it south? That seems to be always the thing that that kind of remains unsolved.
Jenny Stiletovich covering the environment for our partner, the Miami Herald, Kimberly Miller watching the environment up in Palm Beach County for the Palm Beach Post, and Ron Bergeron, the intended nominee for the South Florida Water Management District. His appointment announced by the Governor Ron DeSantis this week. Mr. Bergeron, any sense of when you'll be able to take your seat?
Probably by the March meeting is where we're headed. And I do want to make it clear that the Southern Reservoir most likely, in what I know today, is going to be important along with pre-treating and storing water north of the lake. You see that the cost of getting quality water once it gets into state waters is dramatically more costly than if you're pre-treating the water before it enters state waters. So I want to make myself clear that it may be that both locations, south and north, are extremely important. We have quality of water and storage to be able to have normal releases at our rivers, mm-hmm. quantities of water that's compatible with our estuaries in the Gulf and the Atlantic, and water flowing south onto Florida Bay, where Florida Bay is experiencing lack of water and seagrass is dying. So it's timing and distribution of the water, storing the surplus water that laid on the land that our forefathers drew a line, right or wrong, 75 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's a big task, but I've always said if we can send someone to the moon in a rocket ship, we ought to be able to save our planet.
Well, he will do that or try to do that as a member of the South Florida Water Management District, managing where water goes and how it goes and the quality of that water in South Florida. Ron Bergeron has been our guest here on the South Florida Roundup. Ron, thank you for your time. Kimberly Miller with the Palm Beach Post and Jenny Stiletovich also with our partner, the Miami Herald. Lots more to talk about here on this edition of the South Florida Roundup, the story of how Broward's former election supervisor got the job. That's after this.
Hi, I'm Scarlett Zepka.
And I'm Eric Zepka.
You're listening to the South Florida Roundup on 91.3 WLRN. Happy Take Your Kids to Work Day.
Thanks, guys. We will hear from more kids at work today on the South Florida Roundup a little bit later on in the program. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening and supporting WLRN. Broward County once again was in the national spotlight during last year's midterm elections. Three statewide races were so close that they had to go into a recount. Now, Broward's now former election supervisor, Brenda Snipes, was at the center of all the drama and the delays.
Our completion was 3:02, and it should have been 3 o'clock. So I think the staff worked extremely hard to accomplish what we have accomplished in a very tight timeline.
But by 2 minutes, Broward County missed out on the deadline to turn in its recounted votes with one of those deadlines. After the elections were finally settled, Snipes says it was time for her to move on after serving in that position since 2003.
I think I have served the purpose that I came here for, which was to provide a credible election product for our voters.
Snipes has faced several other mishaps throughout her tenure in Broward County. They include improperly destroying old ballots, printing ballots with missing amendments, and candidates. After her resignation, but before it took effect, she was suspended by then-Governor Rick Scott. She challenged her suspension, and the new governor, Ron DeSantis, put an end to the controversy by saying he'll acknowledge Snipes' resignation. So what's been your voting experience in Broward County through the years? What direction should the office take now that Snipes has left? How did it get here and where does it go? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. If you want to join the conversation online, it is at WLRN on Twitter. Jessica Lipscomb is back with us here on the South Florida Roundup, a staff writer for the Miami New Times. She authored the piece, How Brenda Snipes Became the Face of the 2018 Midterm Elections. Welcome back, Jessica. Before we answer that question, how she became the face of the 2018 midterm elections, how did she become the face and the bureaucrat responsible for managing elections in Broward County?
So Brenda Snipes was kind of tapped out of retirement. She had been an elementary school principal and a district administrator for Broward County Public Schools. And she had retired in the summer of 2003 when a lot of criticism was being lobbed at the former supervisor of elections, Miriam Oliphant. Snipes' name was recommended to Governor Jeb Bush, who ended up suspending Oliphant and appointing Snipes.
And what was the qualification, what was the background that led then-Governor Bush to appoint a retired school employee?
So Snipes did not have any elections experience, obviously, but Dorsey Miller, who was an advisor to Governor Bush, told me that, you know, Governor Bush was wanting to replace Oliphant with someone who kind of mirrored her. So he was looking for someone that was, you know, perhaps a black woman, mm-hmm. Democrat, someone who fit those demographics. And Snipes' name came up as somebody who, you know, had been at the district for several years, kind of known as this problem solver, someone who was very diplomatic.
Yeah, you mentioned spent her first career in education. What did she do? What was the reputation that she garnered by the time she had retired originally in 2003?
So she kind of had this reputation for, like, going in and fixing things that were broken. She was sent into Markham Elementary School in Pompano Beach, which was one of the district's least successful schools in terms of student achievement, and was able to bring that school up from an F to a C in just a few years. And she also worked at the district level in the training other teachers and employees.
So with this reputation as kind of a fix-it person, back in 2003, which seems like a lifetime ago in terms of elections timelines, and it really was 15 years ago, was were elections broken in Broward County?
Oh, yeah. I mean, during that time period, you had lots of issues going on. Polls were for the midterms in 2002. They opened late, closed early. They had a shortage of poll workers, just all of these crazy things that kept happening. And there was a lot of outrage about that. There were, I think, over 200 ballots that were found in the office several weeks later that had never even been counted that people had mailed in. So, you know, a lot of people felt that Oliphant needed to go.
And of course, who was the Broward County election supervisor at the time? Of course, this was just 2 years after the 2000 election, where Broward and Miami-Dade certainly did get some focus in terms of the recount of Bush versus Gore. A lot of that focus, though, of course, was on Palm Beach County, but nonetheless lumped in terms of Florida and South Florida especially. So what were those early days like as Brenda Snipes came in at a troubled time in Broward County for elections and took over with this reputation of somebody who had been able to address shortcomings within the public education field?
So she only had about a year before her predecessor's term ended, and she had to run for re-election. But she did win the re-election with over 65% of the vote. So voters had a lot of confidence in her that she was doing her job there and getting things into shape.
So those were the early days. She's appointed. She gets elected for the first time. 2004 being another big election year, of course, a presidential election year. 2006, gubernatorial election. What were those early elections like as she kind of came in and took control of things in Broward County for the elections?
I mean, there were problems here and there, but overall, I think those early years are ones she would probably point to as her most successful. She launched this voter registration drive at the schools and in nursing homes and registered over 25,000 new voters from students in her first term. So those were relatively successful
years. She was somewhat reluctant to take the job initially, but then I think by action and certainly by the support of the public really came into it.
Right. Yeah. And one of her old friends, Dorsey Miller, who was the advisor to Governor Bush, told me, you know, she initially said she would only serve out her predecessor's term. But, you know, he cautioned her not to tell anybody else that because he said you might end up liking it.
Yeah, fast forward 15 years later. Right. She ran for election and re-election time and time again and continued to find good support amongst Broward County voters in what is a nonpartisan position for the county, right?
Right. I mean, notably, she, you know, overwhelmingly won every election she ran for. So I think she would also point to that as something that showed confidence in her.
Troubles, though, continued around elections. Wait times were a problem really throughout South Florida in 2008, for instance. There was issues around various ballots in some elections. Missing some amendments for absentee ballots, other problems around missing ballots, misprinting, destruction of ballots that were in question that were still subject to kind of some scrutiny here. Talk to us about kind of this list of challenges. And was it unique? Is it unique to have a county the size of Broward County with so many voters to have these kinds of troubles?
I mean, I think she and her attorney would say, yeah, that's normal. We have a lot of voters here. Obviously, there's going to be more problems. But I mean, there are definitely some troubling things. In 2016, for example, the amendment that would legalize medical marijuana was missing for some voters, which was something she was sued over. And also Tim Canova, a congressional candidate who ran against Debbie Wasserman Schultz that year, you know, kind of sued her and found out later that she had destroyed these ballots ahead of the regular schedule that he was hoping to get his hands on.
Right. And how does she defend her actions and how does she generally kind of defend her office against those kinds of shortcomings that were highlighted several times?
You know, and going back through all of this, it doesn't seem like she gives very specific defenses for any of these actions. Things are attributed to, you know, the large size of the county, as you pointed out, you know, mistakes with personnel, with vendors. But we never really hear specifically what went wrong.
We are speaking about Broward County elections and the now former election supervisor, Brenda Snipes, the subject of a cover story in the Miami New Times, written by Jessica Lipscomb. Your thoughts, your comments, perhaps you've experienced a Broward County election. 800-743-WLRN. What do you want to experience in the next election in Broward County? 800-743-9576 is the telephone number. So how did Brenda Snipes become the face of the 2018 elections and really the midterm election mishaps specifically?
I think, you know, a lot of people latched on to this idea that there was something going on in Broward. They obviously took 4 days to finish recounting, which was legal, but, you know, people were wanting to know the winner. And then, of course, former Governor Rick Scott, you know, came out and said there was rampant fraud.
Yeah, that was on election night.
Yeah.
That he said he had to backtrack slightly from that, but because there was simply no evidence of it.
Right. And obviously that triggered a lot of outrage at the office and the protests that we saw.
Maybe the outrage has died down, but certainly the scrutiny on the part of lawmakers has not died down, not just only to Broward County, but the troubles that were exemplified in Broward County at the state level, as the legislature may respond one way or the other and look at the kinds of reforms that were put in place after the 2000 election and where changes may be made. As you went through the reporting on Snipes, Brenda Snipes, and the Broward County elections process, you know, one marked difference, of course, in this cycle versus others was the trouble centered in Broward and Palm Beach County, Miami-Dade County. It was seen as a real model of efficiency, despite the size and the intensity of the election and the short deadlines that were articulated in state law with the recounts. How do you kind of compare and contrast how the counties responded here in South Florida and the differences?
Well, something I found really interesting was I talked to both of the former Broward Supervisor of Elections, Jane Carroll and Miriam Oliphant, and they both told me that they think this office should be non-political. It shouldn't be, you know, a Democrat or Republican outwardly running it. It should just be nonpartisan. And in Miami-Dade, what they have is an office that's run by the county and not an elected position. So a lot of people think that that is one reason Miami-Dade has been successful.
It's an appointed position in Miami-Dade, but that's going to change because wasn't there an amendment, a constitutional commission amendment on the ballot this past fall that voters approved that it mandates that not only the sheriff position is elected, but now the county supervisor of elections has to be elected too.
Right. Yeah. And that's something that we'll definitely need to watch. That could bring a lot of changes into the elections process down here in Miami-Dade.
Meantime, moving forward, Brenda Snipes has retired from the election supervisor position. Governor Rick Scott appointed an interim election supervisor. What can you tell us about the state of the office today?
Well, Pete Antonacci, the replacement, issued a memo last Friday, that kind of listed all of the failures of the midterm election, what went wrong. Unlike Scott, he did not say that he found fraud or ballots coming out of nowhere. He claimed that this was simple mismanagement, staffing shortages, they went over their budget, basically things like that.
So no fraud found on the part of the replacement for Brenda Snipes?
No, none at all.
Jessica Lipscomb, staff writer at the Miami New Times, writing the latest cover story, How Brenda Snipes Became the Face of the 2018 Midterm Elections. Jessica, nice to have you back in the program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We got plenty more to come here on the South Florida Roundup on this Take Your Child to Work Day on this Friday. Also, Super Bowl coming up. It is back this Sunday. WLRN Sundial host Luis Hernandez won't be watching. He will tell us why coming up next. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Thanks again for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson. The Super Bowl returns this Sunday, and yes, the Patriots are playing in it again. This time they're playing against the Los Angeles Rams. The game will be in Atlanta. Now, here in South Florida, we probably just have to come to accept the fact that the closest we're going to get to the Super Bowl, at least for now, is hosting it next year. The game comes back to Miami. The 54th Super Bowl will be back in Miami. It'll be the 11th time the game has been played here in South Florida. Of course, it's a big day for football fans and the casual fans everywhere. Some like WLRN Sundial host and afternoon news anchor Luis Hernandez won't be watching the game, though. He's given up watching football for the entire season. He wrote an essay about it. You can find it on our website at WLRN.org. Lewis is with us here on the South Florida Roundup. A little bit odd to join as a guest, Lewis, as opposed to hosting, I know, but I appreciate it. Really interesting kind of self-experiment you did. What drove you to it? What was the motivating factor?
Well, this is a lot of things coming together over a period of years. And I think that when all of the conversation about CTEs started, I always knew that the game was dangerous. I mean, I played a little bit in high school, and I had a couple of issues when I was playing, but I just always thought that's part of the game, and that's okay. But I don't know, as these stories kept coming out, and it wasn't just stories of players who were aging very quickly and dealing with dementia-like problems, but then you had players who were taking their lives. And one of them was one of my favorite players of all time, was Junior Seau. And, I mean, even though he played a little bit for the Dolphins, but, I mean, I loved watching the guy play because he brought a rage and a violence to the game. And, see, I have to admit, that's what I loved most about it, was the way he played. He took, as the saying goes, he took people's heads off. So when he killed himself, that's when I started to pause and say, wait a second. Something isn't right. I don't know how I feel about this. Should I be cheering a guy on for his violent behavior on a game? It's a part of the game, knowing that this could lead to problems like this.
Yeah, but there's really nothing else in our lives where we cheer for essentially something that could lead to harm at a professional level. You know, construction workers wear hard hats, and you know, we certainly want them to be safe. And you know, other professions are doing everything they can to avoid injury, whereas in football and professional sports, boxing and others, you know, the fan is really thirsty for that kind of physical activity that can lead to these devastating consequences.
It hit me really hard. It was a couple of years ago, and I mentioned in the essay, it was the Dolphins in the playoffs against the Steelers, and I mean, any Dolphins fan, and I've been a Dolphins fan since before Dan Marino ever showed up, so that long. So when we make it to the playoffs, that's an event. And so I was so excited about the game. And anybody that watched the game, I mean, you know, our quarterback at the time was Matt Moore. And in the first half, he took it. It was one of the worst hits I'd ever seen anybody take. And when you watch the video, it is you cringe. You cringe because it looks like he got hit by a car.
He gets laid flat out, just right on his back.
He's on the ground for a while. And then when they lift him up, well, they just sit him up. The camera pans over, catches his face. Look, I'm not a doctor. I'm not going to diagnose a guy, but I don't think it takes a lot to look at a guy. His eyes were pretty much glassed over. He looked like he wasn't there. And my first reaction was, oh, my God, what a terrible hit. But then my second reaction was, oh, dear God, no, we can't win without this guy. We need him in the game. And so, you know, I mean, as a fan, that's how I reacted. And I was surprised. I was shocked when a few minutes later he's back in the game. And I thought, oh, no. That guy cannot be right.
Yeah.
And that's when I just started thinking, I mean, that and the Nick Bonacani tape. And I just said, all right, should I feel guilty watching this game? And that's really the question I had.
The Bonacani tape was, you know, famous linebacker for the Dolphins, known for his hard-nosed style of play. It was a family video on social media, I think, that it came out of him in later years, just recently, struggling to put a shirt on.
It hit me hardest because, and it's not completely related, but, you know, my grandmother died of Alzheimer's, and so I saw her deteriorate over the years. And so when I saw this video, it brought back memories. And that's when I asked the question. I mean, should I feel good about watching a game? I don't know these guys. I have never met them. They're not friends. They're not family. You know, what does it matter to me? What happens to them? And they're grown men. They made the choice to play the game. All right. But, you know, at the same time, I just thought, well, am I cheering on for a guy to hurt himself and hurt other people? And so I challenged myself. I said, this wasn't political, and I wasn't trying to tell people to follow me and, hey, let's all hate football. I don't hate football. I just wanted to challenge myself for a year. I wanted to see by the end of the year, should I still feel guilty about it?
Yeah. You didn't publicize this. You weren't tweeting about it and you know, offering your thoughts in real time on social media. You and I talked about it in the newsroom on Monday mornings, for instance. How did you find yourself on Sunday afternoons and Monday nights, for instance, after, frankly, being that football fan for so many years and having it part of your weekly schedule when it comes to the fall.
At the beginning of the season, it was really, really hard. I mean, it was, you know, because I was just the habit was go turn on the TV, and not just Sundays. I mean, Saturdays watching college football, and I would just, you know, and so I plan in the fall, I planned my weekends around that, and I turned on the TV, and the game's about to start. I'm like, whoa, whoa, wait a second. No, I said I wasn't. The first few weeks, it was really, really difficult. And look, it's not like I was living under a rock. It's not like I was trying to hide from football. Obviously, Twitter, Facebook, I knew what was going on because everybody else was talking about it. I think one funny moment, by the way, was when the Dolphins beat the Patriots in that really crazy last-second play.
Yep, the Miracle of Miami.
Yeah, my uncle texted me, and he was like, what an amazing play. You must be bouncing off the walls. He didn't know. So
you didn't share it with your family that you had given up watching football?
No, I just told a couple of people. I told folks here at work and a couple other people, but I told my brother, who is also a big fan, and he didn't believe me. You know, for the longest time, he's like, no, you're watching. I was like, no, I have no idea what's going on. But yeah, my uncle texted me. That was a funny moment. And I went back. Obviously, it was on Twitter. I saw the play. And then I texted him back. Yeah, I just saw the replay. But I'm not. Then I explained it to him. And he's like, oh, okay. Huh. Well, good luck with the rest of that. So, I mean, you know. Because he's a big Chiefs fan. So he's not going to talk about hating football.
Yeah. Now, you did fall off the wagon once this season, right?
I did. It was a promise I had made to a coworker. You know, Teresa Frontado is a big – well, she's a Michigan alum, and I used to work at the University of Florida. So when these two teams play, we always have a lot of trash talk between each other. And so I had promised her before. I said, let's watch the game together. And so we did. I will say this. It was weird. It was weird because, I mean, I'm hanging out with a friend, and so we're watching the game and having fun. But at the same time, I'd already been through weeks and weeks of not watching football, and again, I'm watching it, and I'm thinking about that. I'm thinking, okay, you know, and again, I see these guys, and it's just the nature of the sport. It's just violent, and I'm watching it. I'm thinking, you know, that kid is hurting himself. I'm sorry, not just to call him a kid, but, you know, these are college students. You know, guys are – I saw a couple of guys taken off the field for injuries, and I thought, am I okay rooting for that? I mean,
There's such a social aspect to being a football fan. I mean, if you're going to the game, there's the whole tailgating aspect, the aspect in the grandstands and the seats. But if you're just watching it on television or listening to it on the radio, odds are you're doing it in some kind of social environment. How did you look to kind of replace that with something else? I mean, essentially, what'd you do with your time?
Oh, yeah. No, that was, you know, the tricky part at the beginning. I realized that I'm going to have to, you know, plan my weekends out differently. But, you know, the obvious is obvious I had more time to read. But, you know, I did. I found other things to do. And really what it was projects that I had always had on the back burner. All of a sudden, oh, wait a minute, I have the time to work on these things. Now I'm going to work on these things. And once I dug in and started doing them, then all of a sudden my weekends, I wasn't worried about. There was always the anticipation of the game. And when Saturday came and Sunday came, the anticipation, get everything done in the morning because by noon, 1 o'clock, game kickoff time. And now it was, you know what? I'm going to have time to, in the morning, relax, go have breakfast. You know, spend a little time just relaxing, reading, catching up on other things, and then working on the things I wanted to do. And I wasn't pressed for time. I got used to it over time. By the end of the season, I wasn't thinking anything of it.
So the Super Bowl Sunday.
First time in decades I'm not watching the Super Bowl.
You're going to continue through.
I have to. I'm going to finish it through because if I've gotten this far, I mean, that's why not? But and look, I mean, I've had people say, oh, you're not watching because the Dolphins are terrible. And my answer to that is they've been terrible forever and I've still been watching. So what's stopping me now? Sure, yes, of course, I'd love to. There's still a part of me as a fan and I'd love to see the Patriots lose. But but, you know, no, I'm actually thinking, OK, what am I going to do with my Sunday? And just thinking about other things to do. And you know what? The next day, I'll catch all the Super Bowl commercials online, and I know what will happen because people will talk about it.
Yeah. Have you given any thought about next season?
Oh, I don't know. It's I miss the game. I'm not going to lie. I do. I miss, you know, there's, it's a fascinating sport, and it, yeah. I've been watching it for years, and, you know, I still consider myself a Dolphins fan, and maybe. I'll just have to ask myself the question, you know, can I, and it's not just, look, it's not just, you know, the story of Matt Moore or Nick Bonacani. I mean, throughout this fall season, you know, on Sundial, we did a series about, you know, high school and
right.
the dangers of high school. And I'm going to tell you, one of the ones that really hit me hardest was when I spoke with this one woman here in South Florida who, back in 2012, her son had suffered over a dozen concussions between peewee football and high school. And he had a lot of issues that he was dealing with, and then eventually took his own life. And I just think to myself, all right, can I ever really get back to that point and say, I'm going to set aside all this. These people are making the choice to play a dangerous game, but I want to be entertained. Mm-hmm. I have to make that decision. I'm not sure yet.
And making your own choice. Lewis, thanks for sharing your experiences with us.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Lewis Hernandez hosts Sundial here on WLRN Monday through Thursday at 1 o'clock. Finally on the roundup today, are there lots of young faces in your workplace today? Today, Friday, is Bring Your Kids to Work Day across much of South Florida. So it got us thinking about work and getting started in the workforce. We asked listeners about their first jobs in South Florida.
Hi, this is Justin and Dania. My first job was as a commercial bait fisherman at night in high school. Me and another kid would go out and we'd fish all night. In the morning, we'd bring in the bait fish and the owner would sell the bait fish to the sport fishing boats that were going out for the day. One night we were out there and it was just calm. And on the edge of the sky, we saw what looked like a huge wave coming towards us. We're terrified. We didn't know what it was. Then it got close enough for us to see that it was hundreds of dolphins. And they were jumping and dancing and flipping and slapping their tails on the water and chirping, and it was just unbelievable.
This is Lou Gramer, now of Cutler Bay, Florida. At the end of ninth grade, I had failed Algebra 1 and had to go to summer school. My mother had a friend who was a farmer in Homestead and managed to get me some work to make us a little extra money, picking beans and tomatoes. We were paid based on the amount we could pick. The beans were nice because they were up on poles and you didn't have to bend down to pick them too much, although the heat was bad. The tomatoes, though, after a while, they had a tendency to burn your skin. After that, she had another friend who was a manager in a produce packing plant in Princeton, Florida, where we lived, and she managed to get me a job working at that plant, loading up produce into the trucks for shipment. Sometimes the trucks would be refrigerated or have cool water on the floor in the bed, and that was very nice.
You never forget that first job. Martha sent us this on Twitter. At 15, I worked with Miami-Dade Parks and Rec as a registration clerk at Tropical Estates Pool. After checking in kids, I would teach the Red Cross Learn to Swim program to help out. She says she made $3.35 an hour and got a great tan. Dana tweeted us this. Her first job, chicken kitchen. First day, she says she was in the back making the special curry sauce in the bucket and cutting fat from chicken. The second day, she says she's trained by a woman who slapped her hand every time she got an order wrong. Dana says she quit pretty soon thereafter. How about your first job in South Florida? You can join that conversation here on the South Florida Roundup. Sign up to be part of our listener network. Text the word HI, H-I, to the number 786-786-7636. You remember your first job in the workforce? 786-786-7636 to join our listener network. Well, with so many kids around the workplace today, we figured why not put them to work here on the South Florida Roundup. Aiden helps get us started.
The South Florida Roundup is produced by Alexander Gonzalez. Our engagement producer is Katie Lepre.
Hi, my name is Roman. Teresa Frontato is our digital director. Our news director is Taryn Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director.
My name is Valentina. The director of radio operations is Peter J. Merez. WLRN's director of radio programming and technical supervisor supervisor is Jason Zabka.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, tweeting, listening, and supporting WLRN.